This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyes Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
If Jacob Zuma does not appear before the commission, this could really spell big trouble for the commission, because it's going to be difficult to convince anybody else to go to the commission and to speak the truth as is required by the law.
That was political analyst Asanda Ngoyesheng saying former South African President Jacob Zuma's refusal so far to appear before a commission investigating alleged corruption could have a lasting impact. Details coming up also. Water supplies in Zimbabwe's second largest city are set to be restored after a long, hard year of shortages. All these and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. A special commission investigating official corruption in South Africa has approached the Constitutional Court to have former President Jacob Zuma jailed for contempt for disobeying an order to testify. Tuso Kumalo reports from Johannesburg.
In an urgent application to the Constitutional Court, the commission chair, Deputy Chief Justice Raymond Zondo, wants Zuma jailed for 2 years. He also wants the court to compel the Minister of Police to implement, without fear or favour, any order that the court will grant in this regard. Political analyst Asanda Ngoyesheng says the commission is fully aware that Zuma's refusal could cast a cloud on its entire work.
If Jacob Zuma does not appear before the commission, this could really spell big trouble for the commission, because it's going to be difficult to convince anybody else to go to the commission and to speak the truth as is required by the law.
The Constitutional Court had ordered the former president to appear before the commission to answer corruption allegations by more than 40 witnesses. The alleged crimes include that he allowed private individuals to exercise executive powers during his tenure as president. This led to massive looting and corruption. Zuma, however, disobeyed the order, accusing Commission Chair Zondo of bias against him. Zuma's alleged contempt of court has caused serious divisions within his party. Those supporting him have camped at his house to defend him against any arrest. The ruling African National Congress ANC's top six, which include President Cyril Ramaphosa, is expected to visit Zuma's home in KwaZulu-Natal province in a bid to get him to reconsider appearing to the commission. Meanwhile, after a string of pre-trial court battles stretching for years, Zuma's defense lawyers and the National Prosecuting Authority have finally agreed on a date to start his long-awaited corruption trial. He is facing charges of fraud, racketeering, corruption, and money laundering, all allegedly committed before he became president. Legal expert Mpumelo Losgalala says there is always a time when avoiding a trial can no longer be sustainable.
The pressure of making sure that this trial is able to start and end within the quickest amount of time must be felt by both parties. So they want to get it over and done with as soon as possible. All that they need is that day in court so that they're able to defend their clients. In the case of the former president, with the NPA, they want to prove beyond reasonable doubt that indeed the alleged crimes took place.
The corruption trial has been set for the 17th of May till the 20th of June. In this case, Zuma is appearing alongside French arms company Thales. Tuso Kumalo for VOA News, Johannesburg.
Two South African medics are swapping their medical gear for oars as they train for a risky 4,000-kilometer journey by rowboat through the Arctic Northwest Passage. If the 14-member team finishes the trip across the north of Canada to Alaska, they will make history, as all attempts to row the icy waters have failed. Franco Puglisi reports from Johannesburg.
There have been several attempts to cross the Northwest Passage by rowboat, but none have succeeded. A 14-member team, including two South African medics, are training to make history with their attempt planned for next year. Levin Brown is the expedition leader.
Nobody conquers a passage. The ocean allows you to pass, And there's a very important distinction there. We will be lucky to get through the Northwest Passage, to row from Pond Inlet, the top right-hand corner of Canada, to the top left-hand corner of Alaska, a place called Point Barrow.
In decades past, travel through the icy Arctic waters was only possible by large ship. Reduced summer ice will allow the team to row the passage, but the journey will still be a physical and mental challenge. The South African team member Daniel Lobeuth says such a long, confined journey will likely take a mental and physical toll.
We're going to be out there in the elements by ourselves, essentially. And I think after a certain period of time of repetitive rowing on and off for, you know, weeks on end, I'm pretty sure my mind might be the biggest challenge I'll have to overcome. So my fear is that encounter I'm going to have with myself.
Along the journey, Brown says the team will use scientific tools to gather data for climate change and wildlife studies.
We hope to be the first modern-day expedition through the Northwest Passage to highlight, you know, what's happening with the environment and the climate. This is the sort of expedition that wouldn't be possible, you know, 50 years ago.
Despite the history of failed attempts to row the passage, South African medic Dr. Daniel Kutzinger says the team is hoping to finish the trip within 2 months before the winter ice return.
There has been a previous team, I think it's 2013, that also tried to row the Northwest Passage. They were unsuccessful as the ice caught them. So hopefully the ice will stay back enough for us to finish and be the first then to row the Northwest Passage.
The team will launch another expedition to help them prepare. In June, they will row from England, Newcastle to Orkney, a much smaller distance than the length of the Arctic Northwest Passage. Franco Buclisi for VOA News, Johannesburg.
Libya's Presidential Council and the Prime Minister of the new Executive Authority have called for a transparent investigation into the exchange of fire between Interior Minister Fatih Basaga's motorcade and personnel from the stability support apparatus of the Government of National Accord, GNA. The incident took place in Tripoli Sunday. Basaga claimed in a statement he was targeted in an assassination attempt, but the stability support apparatus reiterated that it was a lack of communication and coordination as its personnel's vehicle passed through the convoy of Basaga, whose guards opened fire to heat up the situation. Wolfgang Poshtai, a former military attaché to Libya, discussed the incident with VOA's senior analyst, Mohammed Al-Shanawi.
As it looks now, it seems to be that a car from the Zawiya Protection Force driving in Janzur in the same direction as Bashar's convoy was hit by an escort vehicle driving at very high speed from behind. We'll see what the investigation brings. What is of significance is that the Zawiya Protection Force belongs to the Stability Support Apparatus, which was recently established by GNA Prime Minister Serraj. One person from Zawiya was killed in the crash. Two more were arrested, one of them wounded. The killed guy did not have any wounds from shootings. He was just killed by the crash. Bashaga's security opened fire, but it is not really clear if the other side returned it. After the incident, militias from Zawiya raided and ransacked Ministry of Interior offices in Janzur. During the night, militias from Zawiya protested against Bashaga in central Tripoli at Martyrs Square, shooting into the air. There were also, during the second half of the night, some skirmishes in Gud al-Shal in western Tripoli. GNA Minister of Defense Al-Namrush, who is from Zawiya, and GNA Prime Minister Serraj both ordered investigations of what they call incident, while the Minister of the Interior still talks about a well-coordinated assassination attempt. Such an objective investigation could appease the Zawiya, but it would probably annoy Bashaga's followers depending on the outcome. The situation in Tripoli is currently tense.
It was reported that the interim Prime Minister, Dibeba, promised the Ministry of Interior to Bashaga and the Ministry of Defense to General Haftar. How could that impact the plan to form a technocrat government in Libya?
After yesterday's incident, Prime Minister nominated the Beba will probably think twice before naming Fatih Bashagha Minister of the Interior for his cabinet, regardless what is the outcome of the investigation. Bashagha, who is from Misrata, has already been strongly opposed before by many militias and other influential people in Tripoli. As a current Minister of the Interior, he wants to disband armed groups in and around Tripoli, which is certainly a good idea, but there is the impression that he just wants to disband militias opposing him while maintaining his own militias. The ruthless behavior of his security, not only yesterday, certainly does not do his reputation any good. Regarding Haftar, I don't expect him to become Minister of Defense. On one side, this would cost the Beba much of his support in Misrata and probably also in Tripoli. And on the other side, Haftar has probably no real interest to give up his current position as a commander of the Libyan National Army for a minister's job from where he could be fired at ease. So Haftar would also not fulfill the Beba's requirement that any new minister must be able to work in any part of the country. He is certainly not able to come to Tripoli for any meeting. So I would say it is much more likely that a person trusted by Haftar will be appointed as a Minister of Defense.
CNN reported that the Russian Wagner mercenaries have been digging a trench from Sirte to Jufra with more than 30 defensive positions. Would that be a line of demarcation between East and West in Libya, paving a possible way for partitioning or at best a federation, not a united Libya?
These trenches and fortified positions cover the approaches to Sirte and Al-Jufra oases from the West. Two strategic important locations this LNA is certainly not willing to give up easily, as they are the gateway to the oil crescent. So yes, this could become a military line of demarcation for the future. However, it is certainly debatable where the border between Tripolitania and Cyrenaica is. But whatever options there are for this, Sirte certainly belongs historically not to the Cyrenaica, not to the area of influence which is currently controlled by Haftar. So if Libya becomes a federation with a mutual agreed formula, and this is key, with a mutual agreed formula for the sharing of all of the oil revenues, it does not really matter so much where the border between Tripolitania and Cyrenaica is. But if the future is partition, one should not expect the Tripolitanians, especially the Misrata and also Turkey, give up the oil crescent without a fight. The second scenario is probably one of the reasons why an international monitoring mission for a ceasefire is for the time being not really welcomed by Misrata and Turkey, as this would limit their military options certainly significantly. However, consolidating the ceasefire is also a precondition for a lasting political solution to the conflict. So I would say, while keeping in mind that there is now a new government soon preparing for the elections in December, fostering and consolidating the ceasefire should still be the priority for the international community.
That was Wolfgang Poschta, a former military attaché to Libya, speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohammed Al-Shinawi. Water supplies in Zimbabwe's second largest city are set to be restored after a long, hard year of shortages and more than 10 deaths that have been linked to contaminated supplies. Now, word of power cuts is setting in. Arigando gives us more on the story.
Bulawayo recently resumed normal water supplies at the dams which supply the city have seen their levels rise, some to more than 50% of capacity during recent rains, according to statistics supplied by the local council. Years of successive drought seasons have caused the city's water supplies to run dry, with residents forced to rely on wells and bores. The city's director of engineering services says the city is gradually restoring water supplies back to normal.
The coming in of the FlowSafe equipment means that the city is now getting an additional 55 megaliters of water per day. That will increase our output to almost about 145 megaliters per day across the treatment process.
Some of the official reasons for the water wars are power cuts and obsolete equipment. Dube says that the final solution is in sight.
The replacement of the faulty valves will be completed by the 15th of March 2021. It is from that time that we project that the city will be able to provide water 24/7, 365 days per year. Our dams are currently carrying about 53% and are able to stretch us to the end of the 2022 rainy season.
Dube was, however, cautious to implore residents to be prudent. that high usage of water will be penalized. Meanwhile, a recent fire at the Wange National Power Station, the biggest thermal power station in the country, damaged one of the units which supply power to the national grid, cutting service to parts of Matabeleland North and elsewhere. The damage is extensive, and observers say the country may be plunged into power shortages for a long spell. Economic analyst Reggie Shoko says repairing the damaged units will prove a challenge.
It would depend on whether ZESA has the capacity to pay. Because I understand or know that the Chinese are already there doing, I think, unit 6 or 7. But does ZESA have the money to pay for that service, especially given that this was an accident, it was unplanned, it's unbudgeted. And we all know that mostly these companies or operations in Zimbabwe are hand-to-mouth. I don't believe or think they have an insurance for that.
The utility shortages underscore the need to improve Zimbabwe's aging infrastructure at a time that the country is suffering an ongoing economic crisis. Reporting for VOA, this is Adi Gondo in Bulawayo, Zimbabwe.
Cameroon's education authorities are pleading with parents to return their children to schools after thousands stayed home on rumors that the youngsters could be vaccinated against COVID-19. The exodus shows the challenge Cameroonian authorities are facing to educate the public on the infection and fears of vaccines. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaoundé.
Cameroonian authorities said several thousand children from at least 15 schools had not shown up to class Monday morning after social media posts that the schools would vaccinate students against COVID-19. The disease caused by the coronavirus. 25-year-old police officer Willie Broad Tabot says his neighbor told him about a COVID vaccination plan at school, so he kept his children at home. He spoke via a messaging application from the western town of Kumba.
Right now, the scientific world is not yet certain on the vaccine. As of now, there are different versions. We hear China has its own version, the United States has their own version, maybe Russia has their own version of the vaccine. So I don't trust it, so my children can't take it now. And there are also rumors on social media saying this vaccine is trying to cut down the population of blacks in Africa. So I'm really scared of it.
A member of the anti-COVID campaign team at Cameroon's Ministry of Health, Eric Tandy, says the reports of a vaccination plan at schools are false. He says they sent health teams to schools and communities to counter the disinformation.
With a lot of fake information on social media, the population have some degree of hesitation, but the Ministry of Public Health, in collaboration with all actors and partners, are doing their best to sensitize the population in order to kick out COVID-19 within their communities.
Authorities on Friday said the towns of Kumba and Bafia, 120 kilometers north of Yaoundé, were the most affected by the false claims. Only 200 out of 1,000 children were in class Monday at the government high school in Bafia. An economics teacher at the school, Martina Kube, says social media platforms are being used to send schoolwork to the absent students.
We create WhatsApp groups for each class. We snap the homework and we send it to their parents. We make sure that the children should read. The parents then verify to make sure that the child copied it well.
Kube said teachers also send WhatsApp messages asking parents to bring their children back to school. Health Minister Manauda Malashi, on his Twitter account last week, announced a vaccination plan against COVID-19, but he gave no details on the availability and origin of the vaccines or when the inoculations would start. Manauda said there was a resurgence of COVID-19 in Cameroon, with more than 6,000 new cases and 36 deaths since January. Cameroonian authorities say too many people are failing to use face masks, wash their hands, and socially distance. Cameroon has confirmed nearly 34,000 COVID cases and more than 500 deaths since the outbreak last March. Moki Edwin Kinzeka For VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
With Uganda delaying plans to reopen schools, parents living near the Kenya border are sending their children to Kenyan schools. Catherine Nambi reports from Kampala.
Since the reopening of Kenyan schools in January, at least four Kenyan school buses are seen crossing the Uganda-Kenya border, each day picking up and dropping off students from Ugandan border districts. The children are mainly those in lower primary classes. Geoffrey Kaombulu is one of the parents opting to send his children to Kenyan schools.
Buses from Kenya come and pick them as early as 6 in the morning and are taken to Kenya for study. And they bring them in the evening as the sun sets at around 7. They bring them back to their houses. Then in the morning again, they come and pick them.
Uganda closed schools in March last year to reduce the spread of COVID-19. Many parents, however, feel the school's reopening is long overdue. Child advocates say the long absence from schools has made children vulnerable to abuse such as child labor, sexual abuse, early marriages and pregnancies. Rather than keep their children idle, parents are willing to pay higher tuition fees on the Kenyan side. Stephen Ojambo, a resident of Busia Border District, has three children in Kenyan schools.
Many of these parents are doing it because of convenience, to keep this child in school rather than just keeping him out to remain redundant. Many of them are being taken them there, especially in this primary, middle primary and so on, simply to buy time as they wait for schools to reopen.
Uganda's Ministry of Education has warned that parents are risking their children's lives by enrolling them in Kenyan schools. The World Health Organization reports Kenya is recording more than 100 COVID-19 cases a day, while Uganda is confirming under 50 new cases a day. Janet Museveni is Uganda's education minister.
We can't stop them, but if they take their children to where they may get a problem, they will have themselves to blame.
Currently, only final year students are back to school in Uganda, but the government has released plans to phase in reopening for other learners starting in March. This is Catherine Nambi for VOA News in Kampala.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiyu Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbili Abaru, thank you again for tuning in and choosing The Voice of America.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's newsmaker interview program. Join us each Saturday and Sunday when we talk with authors, analysts, and policymakers who provide fresh insight on topics ranging from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. You can listen to Press Conference USA on the radio or online at voanews.com/PCUSA. While you're visiting our website, be sure to subscribe to our podcast. We'd also love to hear from you. Just send an email to pcusa@voanews.com or connect with us on Facebook at facebook.com/CarolCastielVOA or on Twitter at CarolCastielVOA. That's Press Conference USA every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
The Voice of America's Global News Program, International Edition, brings you an in-depth look at the biggest news stories of the day. Nobody covers the world more comprehensively than VOA. Our correspondents gather the news and the views of the most seasoned experts on international issues. Tune in Monday through Friday at 3:30 and 17:05 UTC on The Voice of America.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bubu music to hip life, bonga flavor to soukous, Afrobeat to ndombolo and makossa to kwaito. The African beat on VOA has it all. and it's happening right here. Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC.